Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com. The program you are about to hear was originally presented at Book Expo America in Washington, D.C. Beyond the Book's Christopher Keneally leads authors Jay Allison, Colleen Espinoza, and Martha Simmons on a pilgrimage to understand better what inspires their books of individual commitment and faith.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this special program here at Book Expo America. My name is Chris Keneally, and I'm the Director of Author Relations at Copyright Clearance Center, which sponsors an ongoing series of conferences and programs for authors and people in the publishing business, which we call Beyond the Book. And I want to welcome you to Washington, D.C. and the Washington Convention Center for what I think is going to be a very spirited and inspiring discussion about inspiration itself. This is famously a nation of laws made by men and women for men and women. And in that way, I think that makes the United States a profoundly non-sectarian and some might even say non-religious nation. Yet we are also a nation of faiths. Religions thrive and multiply here like blossoms on some magnificent hybrid fruit tree in spring. And while the practices differ from church to church and from temple to meeting house, what unites us in this profound sectarianism is a deep trust that God truly has blessed America and always shall. And what troubles many, of course, is that this Almighty is also free to judge us. And in that judgment, he may find, or she may find, America lacking somehow. The ideals we profess to live by, which we have written ourselves into our laws and into our most sacred documents that are on display in this very city, most famously that phrase, all men are created equal, thus present this nation with a challenge, perhaps even a curse. Well, I sound like I might be giving a sermon, don't I? Well, if so, I want to make a little bit of history and be the first preacher ever to cut himself short, because I know that you want to hear some other people talk, and that's our panel here. I'm going to start by welcoming Jay Allison. Jay is an independent broadcast journalist. His work airs on NPR's All Things Considered and Morning Edition, PRI's This American Life, ABC News' Nightline, and other national programs. He is now heard weekly on National Public Radio as the curator and co-producer of This, I Believe. Over the last 25 years, he has created hundreds of documentaries, essays, and special series for national and international broadcast, and has won virtually every major industry award for his productions and collaborations, including 5 Peabody's. He was the 1996 recipient of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Edward R. Murrow Award for Outstanding Contributions to Public Radio, the industry's highest honor. In the long history of that annual award, Jay Allison is the only independent producer to ever have received it. And finally, in 2002, he received the Public Radio News Director's Leo C. Lee Award for Lasting Commitment to Public Radio Journalism. And I want to welcome Jay, who is the co-editor of an upcoming volume, This I Believe. And perhaps, Jay, because of that outstanding record in radio, a good place to start is to hear some excerpts from This I Believe. So we'll do that right now.
This I Believe is a unique space in the media where Americans convene to share thoughtful and respectful statements about the philosophies that guide their lives.
This I Believe. By that name, we bring you a new series of radio broadcasts presenting the personal.
I believe that freedom of speech should not be so abused by some that it is not exercised by others.
I believe in the brotherhood and equality of men.
I believe in a supreme power whose handiwork the soul-enlarging firmament declares.
I believe in being a good friend, lover, and parent so that I can have good friends, lovers,
and the pursuit of truth.
I believe in the power of love to transform.
I seem most instinctively to believe in the human value of creative writing.
If I have one operating philosophy about life, it is this. Be cool to the pizza delivery dude. Tip him well, friends and brethren, for that which you bestow freely and willingly will bring you all the happy luck that a grateful universe knows how to return.
This, I believe, has struck a chord with Americans. A listener in Ashland, Oregon, says the series is a wonderful forum to pause and reflect on our own humanity. It serves as a reminder, which we desperately need, surrounded by trivia and materialism as we are, that thoughts are still what connect us, each to the other and to our world.
That was a nice sampling of the program, which, as we said, is heard weekly on National Public Radio. It was inspired by a similar program from the 1950s. And I wonder if you could talk about that inspiration and also how today's series is different from the earlier one.
The series in the 1950s was hosted by Edward R. Murrow, and it aired every day on the radio. It was a broadcasting and then a publishing phenomenon. The book sold more than any book other than the Bible in those years. It was on the air for 5 years, and they were wrestling with many of the same kinds of things we're wrestling with today. I mean, I think if you read those essays, and we have found in archives all over the country, we now found 1,000 of them, all in the original audio. And we are in the process of transcribing them, and they'll be available in an archive, too. It's a remarkable snapshot of this country at that time. And they, like we, were in a mix of hope and fear. And there was McCarthyism, there was nuclear threat. The issues they were talking about and the things they were afraid of and wanted to make better were very much the same. It was racism and it was immigration. It was America's place in the world. And now 50 years later, the series then kind of went out of completely out of circulation. And my colleague Dan Gettiman and I found the original books and started tracking down the producers. Found Murrow's son and the son of the original producers, Casey Murrow, and said, we think the time is right to bring this back, and we think that people need to talk, or more particularly to listen to one another again without ranting or trying to convince or persuading another of your belief so that they may adopt it too, but simply giving a protected, respectful, safe space to reflect on what has meaning in life. And we brought it back to the air a year ago, and the response has been incredible to it.
And the point you made is that it's important that this is not negative, it's not attacking, it's always very much a positive message, and it has to be something that whoever is delivering it needs to stand by. That's important.
Yeah, the parameters, you can go to our website at npr.org and see. There are very few rules about it, but it is required to be a positive statement. It's not about what you don't believe, and it's not your belief as against the belief of another. And so each statement has to be framed in those terms. And it's not a restatement of any political or religious dogma, because those texts are available. But what is not is is your personal experience, the thing that catalyzed for you the central kind of driver for your daily life, the thing that you organize yourself around, the values that abide. And we've had people writing from, we've had people, centenarians writing and teenagers writing, and we've aired from all spectrums about, and I think, you know, when those kinds of audiences hear each other and hear each other say in a vulnerable way what it is they hold most dear, it has a real power. We now have gotten close to 14,000 essays written for us and sent in over the internet. You know, this isn't like checking yes or no on a American Idol, you know, it's a commitment. And people spend weeks working on it, distilling it, pulling it down. We've had people say it was like trying to pack for a month-long trip in an overnight bag. You know, it's 500 words.
Well, how difficult is it for people to be, as you said, non-dogmatic at a moment in our nation's life when it seems that we're more divided than ever, that people are more crystallized in their positions? Are you finding that it perhaps it's easier than you would have expected? for people to do this and that they've been wanting to do it and it just now you've given them an opportunity to?
People like to preach. and they find in this series because we haven't given them a license to preach, and in fact have pulled their license, they find more subtle ways to do it, and they use the subtly sermonizing "we" to really mean you, and we try to. If we find an essay that does that, we try to pull people back away from that, and we want the essay. Otherwise, we say, look, this is only interesting to the degree it's important to you. Don't tell me how to live or what to believe, and don't prescribe for me. Just tell me what you know. And many people, the ones we've aired, I think, have responded to that call for authenticity, or the call was absolutely unnecessary because what they had to say leapt from the page as being so clear and so from their center that we needed to do nothing.
Have any of the statements surprised you? I mean, is there a belief in something that was unexpected and that therefore really felt to you that was important to put on the air and to eventually put in print?
Can I say they all surprised me? Is that a cop-out?
That's a fine answer. But give me an example.
I was just talking to someone. One that was surprising in literally was one that began its... I believe in feeding monkeys on my birthday, and which is a surprising hook, to say the least. It was a young guy in Seattle who came from Burma, and when he was born, a monk had told his family, make sure he feeds monkeys on his birthday and you, and he will prosper. And so living in Burma, it was very easy to do. There are monkeys all over the place, but in Seattle, there are fewer. And so the narrative really tells the story of how he has abided by this belief and gone and found lab monkeys. He's gone into zoos. He's tried to get into pet stores and places that train animals. Desperately saying, please, just let me feed your monkey. But the stroke of midnight. But the essay really is about a belief in his tradition and his family and honoring them and that it's important to them and therefore it will be important to him. So the belief drives much deeper than the nominal artifact of it.
That particular story illustrates the difference really for your series from the one in the 1950s, and that is more or less... The 50s series was limiting. This is really open to the public, and at least originally in the 50s series, it was famous people. They opened that up eventually, right?
They did. They started thinking, it was a bit didactic. It was thinking, you would like to hear the beliefs of successful Americans, whose lives you would aspire to model yours after. And they realized fairly quickly that was... they were speaking from on high. I mean, if you listen to those 50s essays, everyone spoke in a much more declarative, formal way than they do now. But then they opened it up and they started seeking through newspapers and other outlets to find ordinary people. And we learned from them all along. They did a magnificent job on their series. But we have the internet. I'm able to put out a call on the air on Morning Edition and All Things Considered every time one of these airs and say, this is for you too. And so it has opened it up well beyond our efforts to do so. There's a town in Vermont where the townspeople get together and they wrote this, I believe, and had an event in the library and sold the whole library out. High schools around the country are doing it. It's not from our provocation. It's simply because of the idea is good and there's power in this way of communicating. It's enormously gratifying to us that we've been able to help catalyze it, but we and fundamentally don't take credit for it.
And yet you continue to include, not just, as you say, ordinary people, which would be simply anyone who volunteers for this, but you do have essays by the famous, the well-known at least.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk about an example or two there and what struck you in their contributions, and perhaps also how their contributions have changed from the 1950s.
I think, Let's see, I'm trying to think of a specific one. I admire everybody who's done this. It's an act of bravery. As I say, you're vulnerable. You stand up there. You say, these are words I'll stand behind. And you stand there basically unclothed and without defense, opportunity to spin, refine, retract, equivocate. And you're saying, these are my central beliefs. That's a brave and dangerous act, I think, in a modern media climate which favors attack and rant and mockery. And so the famous people that have done this, I have great admiration for. And, you know, I think they've, you know, I can't say whether they're fundamentally different than they are in the 1950s, but the people in this book have really stood up and taken a chance. And,
well,
you know, I'm admiring.
You teased us a bit, Jay, and told us that Bill Gates has a contribution. What is it that Bill Gates believes in?
He believes in computers. Oh, I mean, it's perhaps not surprising, but he believes in the power of personal computing, and then he goes on to explain how he thinks it will, you know, revolutionize society. It's very persuasive.
Well, I'm going to also ask you for an exclusive here. You've said that everybody involved in the project has written one of these essays, each individual has. You have. You're not going to publish yours. But
no,
Can you tell us what Jay believes in?
The topic line is, I believe in listening. And perhaps that seems odd for a broadcaster. I don't really think it is. All my work's in public broadcasting. I started the public radio stations in my town. I do a couple of websites that help citizens tell their own stories. One's called transom.org, which just won a Peabody, and PRX.org, which is a way for citizens to get their work broadcast. I believe fundamentally in our need to talk to each other, and more particularly to listen to each other. And everything I do in my working life is to figure out how to make that happen, how to get our stories, our truths shared among us so that we can understand each other better. And the only way to do that is through listening.
What, did that come difficultly? I mean, you do a lot of talking, obviously. Was it hard to get yourself to listen? How hard is it to do that as a reporter, for example?
You just have to remind yourself all the time to be quiet. I'll leave it there, I guess.
Okay. Well, can I ask one more question, and that is about the book itself. Describe how
Here's
it's going to come to us.
There are this is an advanced reading copy. It's got a CD in the back. You can get these for free down at the Holt booth. And the CD will be great because it's all the essayists in their own voices, 60 modern essayists and 20 from the 50s. And it's due out in its full version. This is short, about a dozen essays, 10 essays that we've added, some really nice ones. We're getting some really good ones in. If you listen to NPR, I just editing one last night from an interrogator in Guantanamo. It's amazing.
Wow.
Anyway, I recommend it to you. I think it's good.
Thank you, Jay Allison. I want to turn now to someone who really is an expert on preaching, and that would be Reverend Martha Simmons. Welcome, Reverend Simmons. A native of Chula, Mississippi, and the seventh of 11 children, Martha Simmons is considered an elder among women preachers in America. For more than 20 years, she has preached in pulpits across the country and across denominations. More than a decade ago, Ebony Magazine named her on its honor roll of outstanding African-American women preachers in America. In addition to being known for her oratorical skills, she has also served on more than 12 nonprofit boards, and over the past decade has become the primary chronicler of African-American preaching through books, lectures, and her work at the helm of the African-American Pulpit Journal. She is also editor of Preaching on the Brink and 9/11/01, African American Leaders Respond to American Tragedy. She's here today to speak about a book coming up this fall, Preaching with Sacred Fire, an anthology of African American sermons, 1650 to the present. And just as we did with Jay's introduction, I'd like to give you some idea of what that preaching sounds like. So if we could hear the second track on that CD.
We cannot always see the workings of the law. Now and then, God lets us see the flashing of the sword of his judgment.
You talk about heaven, heaven. Everybody talk about a heavenly point.
When Jesus asked the question, my God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? God did not bother to answer. There was silence.
Talk about heaven, children. Everybody talk about a heavenly point.
Well, I think that gives us a rousing way to start with Reverend Simmons, and welcome to Beyond the Book. What's remarkable about your collection is that it really does begin at the beginning for African-American experience. And I want to ask you about those very early days of slavery and what you found through the sermons the role of the church was for that community.
Even though the book title says that it begins in 1650, there weren't any sermons by African-Americans that were printed from 1650 to 1750. The reason we started there is because we thought it was impossible for America to understand this preaching if you didn't understand how the preachers were formed and what it was like to step off of a ship from Africa in chains with your family either having been split or perhaps they died along the way, and what that led you to become in terms of how you approach the divine. So that's why we started with 1650 to kind of give some background on the formative years. In terms of the preaching, by the time you get to 1750, African Americans have found ways to interact with American culture. So the preaching is American, and yet it still has many traces of Africa in it. There's a sense in the preaching that regardless of what we're up against, somehow we still believe that God is good and God is able, which for me, reviewing a lot of this preaching and looking back at some of the circumstances, I found remarkable. I really found remarkable. Sojourner Truth, one of the preachers of this time, started to do some writing after they had taken her son, who was free, and sold him back into slavery. And she, along with some friends of hers who were Quakers, were fighting to get him back. In the midst of that, Sojourner Truth was still out preaching. And even before women were able to vote, Sojourner Truth was out preaching, first of all, saying, I have the nerve to stand up and be a black woman preacher. But also to say, before the word was known, I have the nerve to stand up and be a womanist or a feminist for some at a time like that. So I found the preaching astounding. In the early years because of the circumstances under which the people did it. And for me, going through thousands of these sermons, there was a lot more truth-telling, then than what I've seen now.
Well, clearly the role of the preacher and the sermon has changed in the 300 years since the very first ones were given. And so I'm going to fast forward you to today, and I'd like to hear your assessment of the role of the church in the African-American community and the role that preachers play.
The role of the church in the African, the church has always been central to the African-American community because it was the only place for a time in history where African-Americans had some semblance of power. They could often say whatever they wanted to say. For the most part, there have always been restrictions, and I think there still are in terms of how some preachers operate. But it's always been central. Culture, of course, has made it the case that now the church is not as central as it used to be because there are competing interests. But it's still central to the majority of African Americans because faith is still central. In terms of the difference in the preaching, media is the difference. Media is the difference. Once upon a time, you could be a great orator and die without very many people knowing that you existed. Now, you can be a mediocre preacher, but if you're media savvy, the whole world will know your name. You don't have to have as much to say. You have to have better media people. I think that that's having a very interesting impact on preaching. In addition to this book, I lead the African American Pulpit Journal, which is the only preaching and ministry journal that's non-denomination for African Americans in the country. So for the last almost 8 years, I've gotten a chance to see, because we allow people to submit sermons for consideration for publication, plus we go out and ask for sermons. And it's been amazing to see what people are talking about now and how much it's driven by the media and what they believe will sell right now, as opposed to 100 years ago and the issues of the day.
Media, we think about today, that involves the internet and television and those kinds of visual media, but sermonizing is fundamentally an oral medium. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated, you were telling me earlier about some of the recordings that came out, a series of recordings that were produced in the 1920s and in 1930s. They're riveting to hear, and they reinforce your point, which is that a sermon should never be dull.
In the African American community, unlike some other communities, we don't believe that there's anything wrong with preaching being exciting. We believe that there's something about the divine that ought to excite you. If winning the lottery excites you, time spent with God ought to at least bring you close to that kind of experience. And one of the things that we found while we were doing some of this research is that there were preachers in the 1920s and 1930s who started to record sermons. And most of these preachers now have been totally forgotten by everybody, including the African American community. I didn't know the names of some of these people until I started to do the research and found out that the songs have been re-recorded, the sermons have been re-recorded and placed on CDs, and I was stunned by the sermonizing, just stunned by some of the ways people put together sermons back then. There was a gentleman in the late 1920s, early 1930s, by the name of A.W. Nix. And A.W. Nix had a sermon called The Black Diamond Express to Hell, which he did in 6 parts. It was so famous.
Station to station.
And the way he would begin each part of the sermon is with the phrase, next station! And you see, okay. And he does this throughout the sermon. And the stations are, of course, what you would expect for that time frame. The stations are Drunkardsville, Lying Town, Gossip Junction, and you can't put this recording down. And he became so famous that recordings back then were only 3 to 4 minutes. But he became so famous that he had to keep doing it, and he could only keep your attention by adding another station. So on version 6, I think it is, he goes into, instead of Gossip Town, it's Confusionville. And then there's Plotters Junction. The people were always plotting against the church and plotting against the preacher. And then there's Thieves Town. And finally, there was a gentleman by the name of J.M. Gates who impacted Aretha Franklin's father, C.L. Franklin, Malcolm X's father, who was a Baptist preacher, and no one has heard of this man since he died in 1945. J.M. Gates was the most famous. He actually recorded 200 sermons before 1935. So Gates was so famous that Nix decided, okay, I got to take a look at what he's doing and do some of that. So what Gates did was he actually had people, while he was preaching, sitting in the congregation who would hold conversations with him. It's like, how does that work? It was fascinating. So what Nix did was, for the Black Diamond Express to Hell, by the time you get to version 5, I think it is, he has added a woman in the congregation by the name of Miss Hardboil. And Miss Hardboil talks in the middle of the sermon. She'll say, look at those stupid people up there being taken in by that preacher. Well, of course, as with any good story, ultimately the preacher is able to win her over, and she's glad to get off the Black Diamond Express to hell. And the church says amen. Just wonderful, riveting preaching that speaks to the genius of so many of these people who were not lettered. And then there were the orators who were very lettered, like Frederick Douglass. Most people don't know that Frederick Douglass was an ordained preacher, but he was, and that's where he got his start. So the African-American, there's such a rich tradition of people who are formally trained and people who are not, but all have in common an enthusiasm and an excitement for the time that they spend with the divine and how that's to be communicated to people. So the recordings were fascinating, and we're hoping that after the book is out for about a year that we will develop a CD, because you got to hear this. Yeah. You got to hear it.
And what's important about hearing it, I think, is to be able to grasp that history. I mean, the fact that this is the first such collection is remarkable itself, and that it's possible to forget some of these characters. And that must be something that you are really excited about being able to offer to the African-American preaching community, let alone the entire nation. I mean, a chance to remind themselves of what they've been through and to recognize that they're not alone, if you will.
Yeah. It literally broke my heart about 6 years ago when I started working with preaching and chronicling sermons. I call people and say, we need to print a sermon by so-and-so. And nobody knew where the sermons were. They were gone. Some of the earliest sermons by Martin King's father, they're gone. So many other preachers, and their names are in the literature. And it'll say, Reverend so-and-so spoke to 5,000 last night, black and white, on this issue, and the sermon's gone. Because the African-American community has been and still is a primarily oral community. And no one realized the importance of putting the material in print. Gardner C. Taylor is considered the greatest African-American preacher in terms of oratorical skill that is currently alive. He's considered... we all know Martin King's name, but Gardner Taylor is considered a better preacher. There's only one sermon in existence by Gardner Taylor's father. One. And the father was actually better than the son. But it's gone. So when we got the opportunity to put this in print, we said, it's got to happen. This is tragic that this much history has been lost. And the other thing we realized is that as we started to talk to people, go to people's basements, people's attics, and things like that, is that if you didn't get a hold to some of this material, in the next 25 years, you were going to lose another entire generation. Just gone. Because people don't know the importance of it. They don't see it so much as history that I need to share with someone. They're like, this is just a preacher I heard growing up. And so it became a mission for me and Frank Thomas to make sure that as many people as we can put in print, we put them in print. There are at least another 150, 200 people whose sermons we want to include. And although I'm a preacher and so is Dr. Thomas, we know we're going to be cursed out because of some of the people we couldn't include. But we at least put down enough information, we hope, to tell other people where to start finding some of these preachers. But it became a mission because it's not just African-American history, it's American history. If you could see some of the sermons and hear these preachers talk about everything from why women ought to vote, all women, not just black women, but why women ought to vote, to what it means to have the right to an equal education. It's fascinating, especially during these times when we're discussing immigration and what rights should people get. Just fascinating reading. So we knew we had to save as much of it as we could.
Well, thank you for that effort and continue that mission. And well, just to tell you a bit about the process here, we're going to speak with Charlene Espinoza, and I hope people will stay because we're going to have an opportunity for you, the audience, to ask some of these authors questions. And so please do stay for that, for those of you who are just joining us. I want to turn now to Charlene Espinoza. This biography sounds like it's for several lives, but trust me, it's really just for one. Charlene Espinoza graduated from the United States Air Force Academy in 1987 and was the second woman to fly the U-2 reconnaissance aircraft in the U.S. Air Force. She logged over 200 hours of combat time and was awarded the Air Medal and Aerial Achievement Medal for her service. Currently, she is a captain for United Airlines on the Airbus 320 and 319. Charlene is a military correspondent for Talk Radio News Service and was an embedded journalist with the U.S. Marine Corps 1st Tank Battalion during the Iraq War. She has also reported from Syria, Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, Jordan, and Kuwait. She won the National Federation of Press Women Award and was a finalist for the New York Festival's Radio Award for her coverage of the war in 2003. And Charlene is here to talk about her book from Chelsea Green called Through the Eye of the Storm, a book dedicated to rebuilding what Katrina washed away. And so now we've introduced yet another element in your life, which should seem to be full enough. And I guess the first question to ask is this a Katrina book?
Katrina was certainly the catalyst for this book. It's really a book about the human spirit and the triumph of the human spirit. I had been to Iraq as a journalist during the war, as an embedded journalist, and I went back during the Reconstruction. And from that experience, I had somewhat of a spiritual malaise, I guess you would say. I went back to flying my aircraft for United Airlines, and of course we've had our dysfunction there as well, but we seem to have gotten through that for now. And I was somewhat stuck and disillusioned, but then Katrina happened, and like so many Americans, I felt compelled to act in some way. I was angry, I was bitter, frustrated with our government, but at the same time felt like it was a moral imperative for me to go down there. And my partner Ellen Ratner, who's here today, she had met a woman on an aircraft who has an aunt and uncle in the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, and there are two African-American ministers down in the South, and we asked them if they needed some help, and they said certainly. And so we diverted our vacation and went down a few weeks after the storm. And literally through the eye of the storm, which is the name of the book, through working with these phenomenal heroic Americans. We're truly the African-American church, and the faith-based community in general was the center of community, not a source of divisiveness, but really the first and last responder is how I regain my faith, not only in God, but in the dignity and in the human family and the human spirit. And so I was so moved by them and how they had transformed me through their love, just as Jay's What I Believe individual said, the transformative power of love. I wanted to share that. And I also wanted to raise money to build a community center for them. And so I bought a piece of property in Past Christian, and I've written this story that weaves my life in really with their life. And I hope that, yes, it's a book about Katrina, but just like 9/11, just like the Iraq War and Katrina today, it's an opportunity, I believe, for transformation in this country, healing, reconciliation. And that's really what the true spirit of this book is.
Well, you know, I mentioned with some levity about your life and just the remarkable things that you have done and some things that have happened to you that I'm sure you think about from time to time and find hard to believe. And I think that's what makes the book interesting, is that it is not only a Katrina book. It really is a memoir, whether you want to admit it or not. And you brought up 9/11, and I think kind of the, if you will, the bookend experience is 9/11 to Katrina. Something didn't happen to you on 9/11. Can you tell us what that was? And then finally, how that kind of worked its way through in that period of malaise to where you felt compelled to go to Mississippi.
Yes, what Chris is referring to is I was living in New York City. I still am at the time of 9/11. And at the same time, I was a brand new captain based in San Francisco. And I had a trip on the 12th of September in San Francisco. So about a week before I had planned to take flight 93 on the 11th, it was to go Newark to San Francisco. And last minute, basically a few days before September 11th, the crew desk called me and said, your trip has been changed because you flew too much this week, and so we'll just start you off in Chicago. So I was going to be a passenger on that flight. Not actually the pilot, and I was not on that flight because my trip had been changed. But my classmate from the Air Force Academy, Leroy Homer Jr., was actually the co-pilot on the flight that crashed into Pennsylvania, and this was a moment of. I don't know what a moment of truth or a moment of a significant emotional event, as they used to call it at Behavioral Science at the Air Force Academy 101, where I just couldn't believe it. First of all, that 9/11 had happened. Here I'd served in the military 13 years so that this would not happen. People would not drop off their children, go to work, and never come home. But I also felt like, why Leroy and why not me? I mean, he was a phenomenal man. Had worked his way up from nothing, really inner city, and we had gone to even the military prep school together, and he had a beautiful wife and a child that I'd just seen him in June, and we used to run on the beach together in California. You know, hear me, I'm not married, I have no relationship in my life at the time, and it wasn't until a year after that, really, that I was at his memorial service. And it's interesting. I don't think I didn't tell this story in the book, but I'll share it with you since you came all this way to listen to our panel. But I was standing there, and they were showing this picture of Leroy and all of the crew members who died. And they had let these doves go at the same time. And I was just in total grief and, you know, really inside of myself. And all of a sudden, I looked down, and there was this dove had landed on me. And it was as though... Leroy was saying, you know, Chuck, as he used to call me, easier than Sholene, Chuck, it's okay. You know, go out there, live your life, and you know, make this world better. So I feel like this Katrina book is really an opportunity to do that. And as I've said, that, you know, I've had so many blessings in my life. I mean, I flew these U-2s. I got to fly upside down in instructional jets. I've gotten to go to a war zone. I've lived in Mississippi. But yet the greatest privilege of my life is really to feel part of something bigger than myself. That's what I learned in the military. That's what they've taught me, this small community, African-American community, but yet is open to the whole group, white and black, Latino and Asian. So this is really a narrow miss on 9/11, but by the grace of God, I feel like I can... that I'm glad now that I made it. And as much as I miss Leroy, I feel like I'm here for a purpose.
You know, the book conveys your experiences with Reverend Rosemary from the Mount Zion Church and her husband. And for me, reading it, I was struck by the echoes of biblical experience in Mississippi 2005. I thought that was remarkable. Just explain that, in your own terms. I mean, did you feel that too? Did you feel like you were living through some kind of biblical episode?
Since then, I've definitely felt that way. There's a chapter in the book called Amazing Grace, and it describes Reverend Rosemary's sermon, actually. And she describes the exodus of the Jewish people from slavery out of Egypt. And actually, the bishop of the area also gives a sermon around those same lines. And for me, which I don't so much talk about in the book, but since then it definitely has been as though this project, this opportunity to help this community and write about them has been sort of my emancipation spiritually and in terms of my own sense of who I am. But at the same time, as you get out there and you get away from that initial feeling, that initial rush that you're making a difference and you try to raise money for a bunch of poor people in Mississippi, and you try and sell a book for those of you who have done that and promote a book, it is a long ways from home. It's a long ways from the air, which I enjoy. But at the same time, just as Reverend Simmons said, and what I'm reminded of is they say at Mount Zion every day when they have a prayer request is the Lord is able. And, you know, I don't know what exactly, who God is or what God is or how I fit into the universe, but I do know that through this love, this transformative power of love and so much support that we've gotten through this, that yes, the Lord is able, that we are able, as much as I sometimes look back on Egypt longingly and wish that I was just flying my jets like I used to.
Well, you told me that you feel that at this moment in the country, there's this potential, at least, in your own belief, is that there's a shift that will take religious people from a kind of aggressive crusading stance to one that's more... helpful, loving, and you quoted some lines from a song that was sung in church when you were a girl.
Yes, it's interesting the shift that I've seen. I guess I grew up with somewhat of an eclectic religious background, baptized a Catholic, but my mother became a born-again Christian shortly after divorcing my father. And so I sort of went to church 3, 4, 5 times a week growing up. And one of the songs that we used to sing all the time was "They Shall Know We Are Christians by Our Love, They Shall Know We Are Christians by Our Love." And we were not politicized in any way, yet I've seen, if you read the newspapers, certainly in my COPA too, how I grew up and very much counter to what I saw in Mississippi. And not just in the African-American community, but in the tens of thousands of volunteers who still go there today and desperately needed today to rebuild, is this sense of community and love that we're all part of the human family, whether you're whatever race or whatever religion or whatever sexual orientation, you're welcome, that God's grace is sufficient. And I believe, it's interesting, I was running yesterday morning before the conference, and I was running on the mall, and I'd never noticed this about the mall before, but there was President Lincoln, and I realized that he's really at the end of the mall presiding over our nation, presiding over the institutions that can either bind us or divide us, yet he was the unifying force and probably the most perilous moment in our history. And I believe that perhaps, yes, it may seem that we're at that again, that divisiveness, but that the spirit that I experienced in Mississippi and that I see as I travel around the country and people are pouring out their support for this project, I believe in the common goodness of Americans and our sense of hope and possibility and unity over the divisiveness of a political argument, whatever that might be of the particular day.
And if I can, just to conclude our discussion, is to emphasize that the proceeds from the book are to go to construction of a community center in Pass Christian, and that's important to you. It's not the reconstruction of the church there. It's the reconstruction of a community center, which clearly would accept anyone, right?
Yes, and it's interesting because when we first talked about this, Reverend Williams had this vision of an educational center. She'd been a teacher for 33 years, graduated high school at 16, certified as a teacher at 19 in 1965 in Mississippi, and she's recently become an ordained minister. And so I bought this piece of property, and I had intended to deed it over to the church, and then they could build this community center. And she said, you know, let's keep it separate from the church because I want all to be welcome, and I don't want any particular denomination to feel like they own this, and this is really for everyone. And so, yes, it certainly has the leadership of Reverend Rosemary Williams, but it is definitely a very open and welcoming community down there. And right now, there's nothing, there's no community centers, no place for the fire department, no place for the even Chamber of Commerce to meet. And of course, the kids, fortunately, are just walking distance from this piece of property. We hope to break ground right after hurricane season, and this center we're designing so that it will be a shelter for future storms. But it is on high ground and received very little damage during the storm.
You know, can I ask you to conclude then with reading something from a very early section of your book that sort of touches on passages from the Bible that have inspired you?
Yes, this is from the first chapter called Storms. One morning after another sleepless night, I opened my Bible. I hadn't opened my Bible since returning from the war in Iraq. I still carried it in my suitcase on every trip and kept it next to my bedside at night as though it was a good luck charm, but it had lost its status as my compass for life. I opened it to the following passage. Let us therefore no longer pass judgment on one another, but resolve instead never to put a stumbling block or hindrance in the way of another. Romans 14:13. This passage cooled my anger, but I was still frustrated. I flipped through a few more pages and found the parable of the mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. Matthew 13:31. This parable turned my thoughts toward the tiniest of Katrina's survivors, the children, the mustard seeds, the smallest and most vulnerable. But if we did right by them, we could give them a new opportunity and help them grow to become the leaders and protectors of their communities. Finally, I turn to the words, so the last will be first and the first will be last. Matthew 20:16. Throughout my life, I have found strength in this passage. It carries a message of hope into worlds filled with injustice and suffering.
Thank you very much. And thanks to Jay, Reverend Simmons, and Shalene Espinoza. And I'm very glad now to offer the opportunity for anyone here to ask our panelists a question. If I can ask you, because we are recording for TV, to go to the microphone that's behind the cameras there. And we'll wait for you. We have about a half an hour for these questions, so if anybody wants to maybe form a line, that would be probably the best way to go.
Who are your publishers?
Chelsea Green.
W.W. Norton.
Henry Holt and Audio Renaissance.
I'd like to pose this question to actually all of you, but it really comes up in light of some of the preaching experiences that you talked about and the Hurricane Katrina. Do you feel like this really opened a window for a heart shift in America? Because one of the things that I live in Atlanta, it's a very conservative area. One of the things that we've often talked about is how Sunday tends to be the most segregated day of the week still. And it felt, anecdotally right after Katrina, that a lot of churches that might not otherwise have seen the people of New Orleans as their cause were really moved by what they saw on television and other things, and they really did open their hearts. And it feels like that was this very impassioned moment, and it's kind of fading, but you all are out traveling around talking about these types of things and others. Do you feel like it's sustainable and it did start a heart shift, or was that just a moment where we were our best selves and it's kind of over?
It's probably over.
That's depressing.
The Lord is able.
Why is that?
I'm a trained theologian. And one of the things that they taught us in seminary was when you get through and all said and done, please live in the real world. And so I tried to do that. The reason I say it's probably over is because I think it's going to take something even more cataclysmic. That's not a word. Cataclysmic. I knew I could say that. Cataclysmic. It's going to take something even worse than Katrina, I think, to shake us up and make us stop all of this craziness about whose God is over here and whose leader is over here and who's this and are you Christian and are you Muslim and are you Buddhist and which one is right. Katrina, I hope, was a moment where some people got it. And that's the way I kind of try to think about the human family, not so much as all of what America is doing, but what did it do for me? Because I believe that the world can be changed one person at a time. I believe that. And so for that reason, I think that there were great things that came out of Katrina. That's why this woman is helping to build a community center. One person saw it and was moved by it. So I'm glad that Katrina, at least I know, caused that shift in the culture. But I fear that hate and the struggle for power is so ingrained in this culture that it's actually going to take something worse to really shake us up and shake us out of our seats so that church is not something that we just do on Sunday.
Charlene, do you want to try to argue with
I don't argue with her. I guess I would say that the glimmer of hope that I have on this question is that as I travel around, people are still disturbed by Katrina, but they don't know really what to do. So many people tried to volunteer, and they were turned away, or they gave money. They don't know where it went, and they feel betrayed by the Red Cross and these other things. And I think what the best thing that we can do is try to foster understanding, and it's sort of like we fear the unknown, and we can stereotype very easily. And I certainly have stereotyped, and I talk about my stereotypes and how they completely were blown away by Katrina, literally and figuratively, even my stereotypes about the faith-based community. But I do believe that the money in this country goes to polarize us, basically. I mean, that's how you raise money, is some of these, whatever faction or the other, but that America, we're really much more unified, but it's going to take, you know, how do you organize a bunch of moderates or moderates, right? So I think that it takes really understanding and storytelling, whether it's my book or whether you're learning about other cultures through Reverend Simmons or Jay's book, where it's like what I believe and you say, wait a second, that person is nothing like me, but you know what, I agree with him. I think that's what it is. I think it's the dialogue, the working together that will transcend it. But there will never be a one
event, I think, that will make us change, like you said so eloquently. It's one person at a time.
And Jay, can I draw you in and ask whether Katrina changed the submissions that people were providing?
There was a burst of Katrina submission, quite a burst.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. With conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists, Beyond the Book is the premier resource for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.